Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to this episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am your host, Dr. Jake Porter, and I'm really glad that you're here tuning in today for the conversation I'm going to have. When people throw themselves into recovery, they often do just that. They throw themselves, they give themselves over to this process. Not everybody, but I've seen a lot of folks who do that, and I've seen a lot of betrayed partners do that. I mean, when they go in, they go all in. They've read every book on sex addiction and every book on betrayal trauma, and they've listened to all the podcasts and seen all the YouTube videos, and that is wonderful. It is important. Knowledge is power, and it is empowering, allowing you to make informed choices for your own life and direction of your life. And so that is such a good and crucial thing. And I've seen folks just really latch on and go find support communities and find a therapist or coach or both and do all this work. And that is so crucial, especially at the beginning phases of recovery from betrayal trauma, to have that support and have that structure that creates stability there as you're getting over the initial blow. I've also, though, seen it happen that sometimes people who are further out in that process, further along, they begin to bump up against their own structures of support and recovery and healing in such a way that they begin to maybe find that some of what they've put in place is no longer serving them as it did at first. And they have to begin vulnerably making choices to let go of pieces of the self-help process that they've so rightly put together initially. Well, today I'm going to be joined by one of my colleagues here at Daring Ventures, my practice, Jessica Guillory. Jessica is a licensed professional counselor in the state of Texas. She is APSATS trained in the multidimensional partner trauma model, and she's also trained in several other modalities, EMDR, AEDP, which is Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy, and she's a CSAT candidate. And has been working with betrayed partners, with addicts, but especially with a lot of couples. And this is a conversation that she and I have had offline, and we thought it might be beneficial to have it online with you so that you could benefit from it. So we're going to turn to that conversation with Jessica here in just a moment. Before we do, I just want to say right now at the APSATS website, APSATS.org, look into the trainings that are coming up in just a few months. We're not that far away from the summer. And in June, APSATS is offering its signature training on the multidimensional partner trauma model, as well as a training on betrayal trauma for religious leaders. If you have not gone through those trainings and you fit in a category of someone who wants to walk alongside those who are trying to move through a healing process after the discovery of betrayal, I cannot encourage you highly enough to go check those trainings out. All right. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Jessica Guillory. Well, hello, Jessica. Thanks for being willing to come on Betrayal Recovery Radio.
Yes, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and I'm excited about this topic. When I first approached you about being a guest, it was exciting to hear this idea because it's not one that would have come to me naturally. Basically, you said something like, how to know when you should stop working on yourself.
Right. Yes.
Which is, go ahead.
Yeah, if any of my clients are listening, they perhaps have heard me fuss at them about this very thing. So
Right.
I
Yeah,
had to dive.
because so many times we're trying to get clients to do work on themselves. And in fact, clients come to us because they want to work on themselves. And you're saying we need to talk about when you should stop working on yourself.
Right.
So can you say a little bit about maybe what got this idea in your head initially?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So I'm aware of imagining that we live in a very wellness-oriented culture right now, where there's infinite resources for self-improvement, infinite therapists, right, to support that journey. And there can be something called toxic, right, wellness or kind of an obsession or a fixation. If we think about over-exercising, I want to posit that there's something similar for over-recovering. A little
Okay.
bit controversial, but stay with me here.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to hear it out. We're going to have this conversation. But where I thought we would start, as I thought through this topic, is, before someone can stop working on themselves, they have to begin working on themselves. Right?
Right.
I can't start something I haven't started. Stop something I haven't started. Right. So I want to start with this. Why is it important for someone to take ownership of their own healing or recovery process in the first place?
Right. So I experience kind of two types of clients that come in. There are maybe marriages or individuals who are in crisis. Right, where if they don't seek immediate help, the coupleship or their personal psychological help will blow up, right? They need immediate care. And so of course, obviously the journey is very important to begin if you are in crisis. The second type of client is people who want to brush up or people who want to tweak things that could be improved. And then there's a third kind, and this is the population that I'm speaking to, the kind that have worked very hard and have forgotten how to rest. So, but we'll get to that third person later.
Well, okay. So actually, I kind of want to get to that third person right now, if that's
Sure.
okay. What might be some signs that that's you?
Yeah. Do you mean me specifically, as in I'm one of the people that I
You
would
can
talk to?
answer that however you want.
Yeah, whenever I feel called out, it's because I'm relating a little bit too deep.
Sure.
And maybe that's why I can recognize it, so clearly. So some signs that you might be in this third category. Do I dread beginning my self-care routine? Right? Do I feel depleted even after doing things like meditating or going to my counselor's office, right? Do I find myself hesitating to rest? Because that thought in my head is, but you need to recover, you need to keep healing, you need to keep growing, right? Has my inner critic latched on to this idea of recovery as a tool, right, to beat myself up with?
Oh, wow. Okay. Thanks. So when I think about this, and I've certainly had that conversation with clients where I say, hey, I think it's time to pull back from some of this work. I think it's time to introduce some other forms of self-care that aren't directly related to, addiction recovery or betrayal trauma healing or whatever. And what I begin to notice often for a lot of those folks is that their recovery is beginning to become an end unto itself rather than a means to a different sort of end. Do you see that as related to this topic?
Yeah, let me reflect what I hear you meaning, what I'm taking in. Instead of I am recovering to, say, have more health or happiness in my experience of my marriage, or I'm recovering to be able to move more freely throughout my workplace or to be more productive or, whatever it may be, to sleep better, that goal becomes blurry and recovery itself is the task to be completed.
Yeah, it's the end game. Like I'm recovering in order to recover. But
Right.
recover to what? Recover what?
Right.
To get back to what? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And
I'm sorry.
That's,
repeat your question.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you see that as related to this topic, that maybe the folks who have reached a place where they need to start shifting maybe in how they even define and think about self-care and growth and all of that. If maybe a means has become an end, and it was never meant to be an end.
Yeah, I don't know how clinical your language usually is on this podcast, but I want to frame it like a coping mechanism, right? If I'm trying to resolve a threat with something that's threatening, right? Like if I'm in high charge as I'm trying to resolve what the charge is, right? So recovery is a useful tool to move out of distress, right? But if I'm not resting in between workouts, I don't know, I keep using that that analogy.
No, I think it's a fit analogy, yeah.
Right, yeah, if I'm not taking rest in between workouts, do my workouts get more effective or less, right?
Right.
Does my motivation to, you know, visit the gym another day increase or decrease, right?
Yeah. And that actually fits with, I'm thinking as you say that, it fits with what we know from the research into neuroplasticity, that actually the more permanent sort of connections that need to be formed for there to be changes to the networks in the brain, those happen not during the work itself, but in the period of rest after the work. And so if I'm always go, 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 and I'm never in that place of rest, then my labor is in vain. Those more permanent connections don't actually form in my neural networks. Yeah. So let's try to get real practical with this. Like paint a picture, and maybe we do this for both an addict, one who's in addiction for, or I'm sorry, in recovery for addiction, but also maybe a betrayed partner who's in a process of healing there. What might this look like for each of those folks?
Ooh, and can we add a third, what this would look like for a coupleship?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, so maybe we can start with betrayed partners.
Okay.
This is a real-life situation that I encounter quite often. There are support groups that are named aptly, right, to a place to go to be around like-minded people who have similar journeys and stories, right? And it's tempting to stop listening to my body, right? Mm. Stop listening to my physiological response while I'm completing this recovery task, right? So maybe the rule or the law in my mind is I need to do this because this is what recovery is. But one day I'm especially triggered, right? Or I just wake up kind of in high arousal, right? Going to ISA or going to, you know, RCA that day might be not what my recovery needs that day, right? If I find myself having a panic attack while a sister is sharing, that might be an indication, there's a different self-care tool that I need to bust out today, right?
Right.
And so having that grace and flexibility can be hard sometimes when we're, you know, committed stoically to checking off the boxes of our recovery.
Yeah, and I've encountered that as well, where a betrayed partner has to wrestle with, did this particular support group or this particular program that was so helpful and did serve them so well in one stage of their process, now maybe it's more triggering. It keeps them more stirred up. It keeps, you know, it keeps them in a heightened state, hypervigilance. And they go, I'm not sure if this is serving me as best it can, right now. So, okay. Yeah. And another one that I hear a lot, and I mean, this is a little bit almost like hypocritical because here we are on a podcast, but I've said to people, like, maybe cut back on the podcasts and
maybe
the blogs.
Listen to some music.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, right.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe pull back a little bit on that. Because I think that all of the information, while absolutely critical, especially early on, right? Knowledge is power in that way. Mm-hmm. It's very empowering. But I get a sense sometimes that it keeps people in this cognitive place where they're not having to feel maybe some more affective, emotional realities.
Right. And I also want to validate, just kind of echoing what you're saying, there's a plethora of podcasts, YouTube channels, you know,
right.
Professionals to reach out to, right? And so I'm overjoyed that that's an option in this age. And I would be hard pressed, you know, not to take advantage of it myself if I were in that situation. And we go back to, what does it look like when my body is telling me something else, right? Have I set up my recovery in a way that I'm only engaging with my mind or only engaging with my list or my rules versus coming back to my felt experience? And when I feel that burden, do I have the tools to choose kindness towards myself? That's really what I'll be emphasizing here. Like, do I have the tools to choose radical self-care that looks like not doing a daggum thing sometimes, right?
yeah. I call that recharging on the couch. Just get on the couch and recharge,
sure.
You know?
Right. Yeah. What's that yoga pose where you just lay out and your limbs
that's my favorite one. Yes. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, and I haven't forgotten that we're going to also do the same thing for those in recovery from addiction and also for a coupleship. Mm-hmm. But a couple times now, maybe three times now, you have mentioned rules, right? Mm-hmm. Like the formation of rules. And I want to just pause on that because I think that's a really important concept for people to maybe become aware of, because not everybody, but a lot of folks, and it's not a bad thing, right? They're just genetically, biotemperamentally wired
right.
to be a little more rule oriented.
Right.
And pair that with the experience of betrayal. And what I'm thinking, this is kind of real time processing, which is dangerous, but I'm gonna do it anyway. what I'm thinking is that especially if you've just discovered that your reality as you knew it was not as it was, right? And that whole storyline's been blown up. Finding rules.
Oh, it's so comforting.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like, here's something that's certain. Here's something I can really, you know, hang my hat on.
Mm-hmm.
And so rules can serve us until we start serving them.
Right.
And I think that's what I hear you saying.
Oh, I like
right?
that, Jake. Yeah, I'm
yeah.
Gonna use
someone
that.
Should write that down.
Yeah, rules serve us until we start serving them. That is so poignant. Yeah, and notice maybe I've been doing it well, though imperfectly. Even as I'm framing, you know, this idea of choosing not to over recover, right? I'm not using the language of should. Right. You should stop going to this program once you feel this way. Right. Because far be it from me to cure your rules with rules, right? Or to cure your fixation with a fixation on another checklist. Right.
Yeah.
And so the whole key here is, what does it feel like for you? And do you have access to choose something different?
Yeah, that's really good. It's really good. One of the other things that I know I've shared with betrayed partners is that we know trauma typically makes our world smaller, right?
Mm-hmm.
More things are threatening, more things are unsafe, more things are uncertain. I have to have more boundaries, more fenced in. And so at first it makes our worlds much, much smaller. Recovery, mm-hmm. we want recovery to open us up to have
right.
A bigger life, for there to be more options. And sometimes I think those rules that we create and these rules about our own recovery actually end up keeping our lives smaller,
mm-hmm. right.
but it feels safer.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say to a betrayed partner who's kind of got the cognitive awareness of that dynamic, but maybe he or she's just afraid?
Right. Yeah. So I call upon people who are willing to give us not tough love. I don't love that phrase, but like disconfirming love. I'll put it that way. Right.
Okay.
So the people who maybe know us and know what we tend to go to when we're trying to regulate, chances are the people closest to us have observed that we like rules, right? Or have observed that we go gung ho whenever we're under stress. And so if you need accountability to go opposite of, something in recovery that you're fixated on, schedule, right? Schedule with a friend. Hey, I'm going out with my dude, right? If you're a guy in betrayal trauma recovery, like organize a lunch, right? Call a friend, right? And that way you're filling the time with something, right? Because it's not just an absence, right? It's a presence.
You're talking about something that I find myself pointing to often. It's not enough to say I don't want to do that. What am I going to do instead? Yeah, so finding that positive direction to head into rather than just trying not to go another direction. That's okay. That's good stuff. All right, let's move to what might kind of that over recovery look like for someone in addiction recovery.
So I'm open to your feedback, Jake. I'm gonna say some stuff and I'm gonna
Uh-oh.
maybe stir a pot.
That's
Yeah.
okay. It's a safe place
So
for conversation.
yeah. So there are some people who are recovering from compulsive sexual behavior who have loaded their schedule every day of the week, including Saturday and Sunday, right? With group therapy, with meeting with their CSAT, with couples therapy, with 12-step, right? And so there is no space, I kid you not, this is a real life example. There is no space for quality time with my spouse, right?
Sure.
There's no space for me to work out, right? There's no space for me to just enjoy a movie that I wanted to see, right? And so I do understand why the schedule tends to get that way, especially as you're, trying to meet partner requests, right? If you have a partner who enjoys rules, especially, right? The more the better. This is what makes me feel safe, right? And am I allowing my schedule to have margins, right? Not margins for acting out, but margins for outer circle, life-giving, right? Restorative behaviors. Not saying 12-step can't be restorative, not saying couples counseling can't be restorative, but when do I have fun, right? When do I live the life that I
Fun.
can
F
live?
what?
Right. When do I have time for the things that I can do now that I'm in recovery or can
Yeah.
experiment with doing now that I'm in recovery? I think there's a fear, if I may be so bold as to speak for recovering individuals, there's a fear of if I go back to living loosely, right, I'll relapse or I'll go back into not setting good boundaries for myself, right? But this margin to fail well, right, I think is the secret sauce of true recovery, right? Can I get used to failing well? Can I get used to making amends when I'm not perfect? Can I respond with flexibility when I've hurt someone, right?
And when you say fail well, you're not necessarily talking about acting out again or loss of sobriety. Yeah. So can you speak to that?
Thank you. Yeah, so one example, I have a couple where their friend group has been changing just as they're navigating recovery, right? And so the acting out partner, hey, I would like to spend time with this person, right? I gave them a call. Maybe they receive feedback, hey, I'd really prefer you not call them unless you let me know that you're going to call them because they knew about your acting out, right? And so absolutely, yes, I'm responding with humility. Yeah, I tried to do a good thing for myself by reaching out to a friend, but I see that that hurt you. Thank you for letting me know. How can I do
Right.
that in a way that makes you feel safe, right?
And I also want to say, kind of like we said with betrayed partners in their own healing process as well, there are some addicts, I think, as one who's treated a lot of addicts, that initially, I mean, when someone is just getting started and they're just trying to not act out, then yeah, do the 90 and 90. Fill up every day. I mean, that initial surge. But if I tell people, if we're 2 years in, and you're still at that same level, how do we know how deep and internal the change is?
Right.
Right? How can, if I'm the betrayed partner and my partner who is in addiction recovery has no room, right? Has no room to demonstrate transformation, mm-hmm. healing, change apart from this really full structure.
Right.
Then I'm going to always have that question in my mind of, am I safe with this person without it? And then that's where we got to help people realize, and it's not an all or nothing off on switch, right? We can ease our way back into these other activities of life.
Right. Yeah. I think of our distinction at the beginning of our time of the three types of people, right? If you're mm-hmm. in crisis, that's probably not a good time to experiment with flexibility, right?
Sure.
Because you don't need
right.
it. Right? You need structure. You need, you know, high level of care, right? You need a high level of vigilance around, you know, the things that could, you know, slip you back, I guess, right?
Right.
Or if you're just looking to tweak stuff, chances are you've maybe done well already with experimenting with flexibility, right? And tune-ups are more than welcome. I'm not going to scold you about over-recovery when you just want a tune-up, right? I honor that. But that third space, right? I've been stuck in my rules for multiple years, and I don't know how to get back out. I don't know how to feel safe unless I'm, you know, hyperbolically engaged, right, with rigidity. And that's where I ask, okay, is there some space for healing around that rigidity that's necessary? And that is a scary process because, once again, last time I was not hypervigilant, my life blew up, right? I got hurt.
Yeah.
But we ask these things because they're real, right? They
sure.
lead to something.
Sure. Okay. So let's do the coupleship now. What does it look like if a relationship, a dyad, you know, as we often refer to them, if they are over recovering?
Yes. So I have heard the words, we are going to recover even if it kills us.
Okay.
And I loved that so much because it, not because I condoned it, but because it embodied this idea of the coupleship is no longer the thing that's being cared for. It's the sacrificial lamb on the altar of whatever we've conceptualized as recovery, right? So we're going to do couples counseling every week, even if, you know, we notice that we no longer have time for date night. Right. We're finding babysitters specifically so that we can go to 12-step stuff instead of babysitters for, you know, something else, anything
yeah,
else.
Right? Yeah.
Those couple things that we get to do when we're in recovery. Right. And so even within session, and I'm speaking kind of just from my experience as a couples counselor, even in session, when I get the sense that keeping track of the other partner's recovery has become the goal rather than connecting, right? Mm. So keeping track of the other's adherence to our recovery goal rather than I'm keeping track of your well-being because I care about you, that usually indicates to me that somehow we've gotten off track and our priorities have shifted to something not sustainable.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, okay. Yeah, I'm thinking about this. I hadn't beforehand thought about this from a couple, you know, as looking at the unit, the couple's unit over recovering. And I definitely see those markers that you just articulated. And even as I'm listening to you, one that's coming up for me is a couple that all they ever talk about is recovery. All they ever talk about is recovery. And I have seen this both ways. So I've seen it to where the recovering addict is the one who can't talk about anything else. And maybe his partner or her partner is like, hey, I want more to life. And I've seen it the other way around, right? Maybe the recovering addict is wanting to expand that outer circle and bring the partner in on that. But the partner's like, no, only recovery stuff. And I've watched the dynamic, it's like a tug of war happening then within the coupleship, to where we teach this concept of mismanaged thirds, right? So if the couple is the dyad, you know, and the dyad is supposed to have a place of priority, a mismanaged third is anything that splits the dyad, right? Anything that comes between the couple. And recovery can be a mismanaged third.
Right. Yeah. And what comes to mind for me, and I might just be echoing what you're saying, so that'd be fine too. If recovery is the only thing that it feels safe for us to talk about, right? Or if recovery activities are the only things that feel safe for us to engage in as a couple, right? Once again, crisis stage, that makes a lot of sense. But if we're 3 years in and we can't spend time together unless we're talking about the safe topic of, you know, what did you talk about in your meeting, or
right,
what's your sobriety date, right? Is that hindering a deeper intimacy?
Yeah.
And can we look at why that is, right? Why is that a safe, you know, triangle that we've made to keep us from each other rather than moving towards each other?
Yeah. And another thing that's coming up for me thinking about this is, and folks who've followed me for a while, this probably won't be the first time they've heard me say this. And I always start with the disclaimer. I support 12-step programs. I myself identify as a grateful 12-stepper. So I'm not slamming them entirely. And I want to recognize that more traditional 12-step models do encourage a certain, you know, your side of the street and your side of the street mentality, and a prioritization of my recovery is my recovery, and I've got to put my recovery first, that can really have a detrimental effect on the partner and on the relationship as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I in couples, we talk a lot about like managing safe distance. Right. Mm-hmm. Has recovery become, right, has staying on my side of the street become a way that I can stay a safe distance away from
avoid.
You? Right. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Avoid, shield, protect, hide, you know, and I mean, if a couple is okay with that, like if a couple wants to have their own sides of the street, that's their prerogative.
Sure.
But most of the couples that I know we see want to live in the same house, you know, metaphorically and probably for real at some point, you know.
They want to enjoy each other's company. They want to be able to laugh together. They want to be able to share, you know, their deeper thoughts. Right.
Right. So I asked a similar question to this earlier, but I want to circle back to it. Some signs that self-help is actually hurting, right? So the ones I heard you say, you know, I'm dreading my self-care routine. I won't rest. As we've been talking, I've kind of been making another list in my head of what some of those signs might be. And a couple of them that came up were, I haven't read a non-recovery related book in years.
Yeah.
Right. That might be one. All of my friends are in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Might be one. It may not. And you said something similar to this, but I just want to make it real explicit. I beat myself up if I don't clear certain recovery bars in my own mind. Or I beat my partner up if they don't clear certain bars in my mind. And again, I'm not talking about acting out. I'm talking about they only made it to 4 meetings, not 5 this week or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Those are great examples. And, you know, we can look like physical symptoms, right, of working too hard. Am I exhausted? Am I having trouble finding joy in the things that I used to indulge in, right? We can look at relational symptoms, right? Have I lost friends because I'm not willing to engage with people that aren't in recovery, right? do my non-recovery friends still know things about me, right? Still know like heart level things about me. If not, what might that indicate, right? Third, we can look at thought patterns, right? What do my thoughts do when I'm over-engaged, right? Am I only thinking about maintaining perfection, right? And if so, what might that inner perfectionist need? Because chances are feeding more perfection to a perfectionist doesn't work. At least it hasn't worked for me yet. I'll let you know, though.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, so let's say someone's listening or watching this and they're going, okay, that's me you are talking about. I'm X amount of time into this process. I've still got lots and lots and lots of recovery stuff going on, but I'm tired. And I'm not recovering to something. I'm just in this like hamster wheel of keep recovering, keep processing, keep healing. How do we stop?
You
What do we
just
do?
stop.
Oh,
You
that's
just do
helpful.
it. Yeah. So I go back to those loved people. And if the only loved person that you trust right now is your therapist, maybe drop the bug in their ear, like, hey, I think I might be working too hard, right? And creating a self-care plan that doesn't have anything to do with your list, right? Like, specifically leaving off the things that have been over-engaged. I know that that can sound like making a separate list of rules, but person who's listening, it's a journey, and that's okay.
And I'm even thinking I'm putting myself in some client's shoes, and even if that feels too scary, maybe just dropping one thing. Like, okay, I'm gonna let go of this one piece and see if my whole world falls apart.
Oh, yeah, run a little experiment.
Yeah, run an experiment. Okay, I have spent every single Saturday morning for the last, 42 months, in this support group. I haven't had a Saturday. I used to bike, cycle, right? Do it 1 week, see what happens. Yeah.
I even
Oh, go
like
ahead.
setting tiny, tiny, tiny goals like, hey, what if you just gave yourself permission to zone out while you're in a meeting? What if you give yourself permission not to share? What if you don't stay for that extra hour of fellowship after the meeting, right? Like just tiny, tiny, tiny little things, any increment, and then just notice what that's like, if it makes any effect over time.
Yeah, maybe even replace a podcast on recovery with a podcast on some other interest. Not this one, of course. This one they'll want to keep in the rotation. But try something else. I'm thinking of one specific partner who I was seeing her and her husband as a couple, and saw them over a period of probably almost 2 years, and toward the end they were reaching, the APSATS model. There are three phases. There's that safety and stabilization first, and then there's that second phase of grief work, and then the third phase of renewal. And they were moving into that third phase of renewal, and she did this. She said, I'm going to make myself, start reading about, and it was politics. That was an interest she had a long time ago, but her life had been consumed by recovery, understandably so. And she started engaging, getting back up to speed, and then engaging at a local level. And I was so proud of her. I mean, she started like she got involved in local elections, and she's passing out yard signs, and she's. And her whole life opened back up in such a
Oh, goodness.
powerful way. But it started with an intentional choice to just make some mental and emotional space for something else.
Yeah.
And that's post-traumatic growth.
Right, Jake, that example captures my heart so much. I'm thinking of the grieving stage, right? What things did I have to sacrifice when I went into this relational ER, right? When I had to put myself back together again. And now that I have resumed some semblance of wholeness, oh my gosh, I can walk again. Like, where would I go, right? I can see again. What things do I enjoy looking at, right? I'm using kind of a physical metaphor, but like, what are the things that I lost that I might, what hope do I have to return to those things? Yeah, and how much fuller will that enjoyment or that participation be now that I've walked, you know, through the valley of the shadow of death, right? And there's life on the other side.
Yeah.
That's so exciting to me.
Yeah. Okay, good stuff. Okay, got one more question. If we could just sort of make a list, the difference between healthy self-care and hurtful self-help. So healthy self-care versus hurtful self-help. So the healthy versus the hurtful. So I've created a tongue twister inadvertently here, trying to bring together a lot of what we said. So the healthy, one of the things I heard you say that I am taking is when I'm done, I feel, generally speaking, I'm going to feel more replenished and rejuvenated. Not drained.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And that doesn't mean, you know, everything will slide off me like Teflon, but like, you know, that feeling of like, man, I worked hard, but it feels good. Like, I feel like I got somewhere. I feel like I'm becoming, you know, versus that dead end feeling of like, why did I do that to myself again? Right. When is this ever going to end? Right. That kind of generative feeling versus that stagnant or like a foreshortened future type feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so then another one that I've kind of captured it through this discussion is the hurtful self-help is going to keep me in that small space, right? That the betrayal created versus the healthy is going to push me out into a bigger life.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be moving me, taking me somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to think of some others that I heard in our conversation.
My relationships will start to widen again, right? Not just in quantity, but in quality and depth, right? I get to talk to people about my innards, if you will, right?
Yeah.
Not just my recovery people, but maybe I'm resuming a relationship with my mom now that I have the capacity to be honest with her about what's been going on, right? I get to risk, you know, making a new friend and having them know the real me, right? Not all introverts need a lot of new friends, but you get what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just talked about something that I think is crucial in this idea of vulnerability. I think healthy self-care is going to require the risk of vulnerability.
Absolutely.
Versus that more hurtful self-help. It's a whole lot of effort, but there's not a lot of vulnerability necessarily.
Beautifully said, Jake. Yeah.
To those more rigid routines or just it becoming checkboxes.
Right. The routine is my armor that keeps me from having to engage with things that might make me grow.
Ooh. Yeah. That's good. That's good. There's also, I think, you know, healthy self-care is actually going to set me up to have a greater capacity to navigate complexities in relationships and in the world.
Right.
Right. It's feeding my ability to take on more complexity. And by complexity, I think what I mean is like, different kinds of personalities and people of different backgrounds, people who aren't the same as me, people who challenge how I think or how I feel, or I'm a little uncomfortable in this situation, but is that okay? And do I know how to navigate that?
Right.
My self-care is tied to my ability to navigate those complexities versus a more hurtful self-help routine. Again, I'm not putting myself in those complex situations. And the problem there is that those are how we grow. Those are how we continue to develop as human beings.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to use another couples example because that's my main gig. Do I get to engage with normal couple problems, quote unquote, right? Can I have an argument about finances? Ooh, you know, or child rearing? Oh, can we disagree about parenting without me, you know, intentionally going back to the tread ground of, well, you don't get a say because blank, 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 right? Am I using that as a cudgel to keep from maybe integrating, like reintegrating through conflict?
Right? Yeah, right. Which is so scary, for a betrayed partner. But where, you know, the conversation that I usually have in those moments with folks is, what do you want ultimately? Like, what are your values and form in terms of a vision for your relationship? And then you get to choose to move that direction bit by bit, step by step.
Right. And chances are beneath the fear or beneath the threat response, what the acting out partner and the betrayed partner is wanting is a partner, right? They're wanting that their person back, right? And so what are the things that move me back towards intimacy with myself, intimacy with my partner, intimacy with the world around me, right? Risk taking and repairing and doing things imperfectly, but being brave, right? Am I creating brave space for myself?
Yeah, that's good. So, as I've thought through this topic a little bit, I wanted to sort of mention this as we close, and then you can give any closing thoughts you have, Jessica. So in my work, especially when I was working more directly with addicts individually, it was common at some point, you know, let's say 8 to 10 to 12 months into the recovery process, that these recovering addicts would say something like, you know, this shouldn't be called recovery. It should be called discovery. I didn't even know who I really was apart from this. I'm learning so much about myself. I'm learning so much about the world, you know, discovery. And if I'm an explorer, if I'm a discoverer, I'm trying to get somewhere else, right? I'm not just like sailing the seven seas in circles. Mm-hmm. Right. There's a destination and maybe I don't even know entirely what it is, but I'm not sailing just for the sake of sailing. I'm trying to get somewhere. And I think that's the heart behind this conversation.
Yes.
And so if you're out there, you're a recovering addict, you're a betrayed partner, you're a couple who's trying to do this together. Think, be clear and be bold and be vulnerable and think about where do you want to go? Mm-hmm. And how is your recovery routine helping you get there? And then be open to how is that routine maybe holding you back? Mm-hmm. And what are some practical things you could do to begin to make that shift? Jessica, what closing thoughts do you have?
Yeah, I want to take a moment to speak to kind of this luxury of curiosity, right? Truly, it is hard fought and hard earned, right? If you are in the grips of trauma, we know how that inhibits our ability to wonder or to dream or to, you know, be creative or to access curiosity or possibility, right? And so hear me say, if it's not yet accessible, that's okay, right? Yeah, we're not holding anything against you.
That's right.
Right? But when that margin of possibility comes, seize it, right? Because that's where the post-traumatic growth begins to manifest. Yeah, you got to seize it.
Beautifully said. Thank you for this conversation, Jessica. Appreciate you. Appreciate all these thoughts. All right. Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS. If you've received help or hope from this episode, I encourage you to share it with someone you know. If you've not yet done so, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platform. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and you can always email me directly at jake@apsats.org. I'd love to hear your ideas, questions, or comments about the show. Until next time, keep choosing to use your voice and live your values. It's good for you and for this world.